Okay. Well, welcome to our Daily Work of Daily Lives. My name is John Beck, and it's been my pleasure we are in the 23rd year of our Brown Bag series. You know, you were asking whether or not you get a degree for attending. I think that the Brown Bag series actually should get a degree for being in existence long enough here at MSU. So, I co-direct our Daily Work of Daily Lives with my colleague, Kurt Duhurst, back in the corner. Just want to make some quick announcements and then introduce our speakers. So, Friday, November 16th, is one of our musical Brown Bags, and we're very lucky to have Sam Gleaves, who is reputed to be one of the finest banjo virtuosos right now in the United States, on top of being a really wonderful folk singer and multi-talented in a variety of regards. But he's doing a talk over at the library in the green room on the fourth floor called See My New Ground Turning, Labor Songs from Appalachia, 1950 to 2018. So I'll pass that around. Then the following Monday, November 19th, Claire Lutz and Khalid Ibrahim are doing a, back here, wonderful, wonderful talk from Claire, and Khalid helped her on that project. Claire was a fellow at the American Folklife Society, and she's actually here in the medical school. So it's a very interesting talk. We had her do a Brown Bag years ago with a panel of people working in home health care, and that's really what this next one is about. It's called Critical Lifelines, the Lives and Work of Personal Care Workers. So come check that out. That will be fabulous, I can promise you. And last but not least, we had four in the month of, our fourth Brown Bag in November is Johanna Schuster Craig, who's talking about changing the narrative, refugees and social workers in Germany. So because of the influx of refugees into Germany, it changed markedly the work of social workers. And so I would commend that to you. Joanna has done field work with a variety of these social workers across Germany, and that's on the 27th. Now, that's a Tuesday, which is fairly rare for us, so we're happy to do a Tuesday talk. But that night, our own Michael Rodriguez, where is Michael? Right there. Michael is doing a talk at the Ari Olds Transportation Museum and showing the half-hour version of what he hopes to be an hour-long film on Ari Olds in the first auto city. And many of you might know, because you're a fairly literate crowd, that our own Ari Olds actually invented mass production of automobiles, not Henry Ford. And Henry Ford always gets the credit, but Ari Olds is actually the man. Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives was the founding co-sponsor of that that specific nighttime series. So we ask you to come out for that. Now there are sign-in sheets that are probably working their way around. Now I'm gonna hand this out. These are available from Darcy and Jim at the end of the talk. And there's also going to be a gallery walk at the end of the talk. So you can go downstairs and walk through the gallery. It's going to be a great talk, but the exhibit is magnificent. It really is. So this is the gallery catalog called On the Job in Abome. And I'll send that around so you can get a feel for what's available at an obscenely low cost of only $10. I think that that really is.
Except we're giving them to them today.
What's that?
We're giving them to them today.
You're giving them to
the people who come to the gallery.
That's as obscene low a cost as we could find. Free to you. Okay. So, but buy them for friends because I think the museum would love it. So I cannot thank you enough for coming. Do sign in. So let me introduce Darcy and Jim. They can tell you a little bit about their background in terms of Peace Corps, if I remember rightly, in Benin. And Darcy has been a beloved and long-time journalism professor here at Michigan State, who is now emeritus. And Jim actually worked in the area of technology and radio, television production, and other things over at LCC. He became an administrator over all of their media services at LCC. And they are doing a talk today, based again in the gallery, but here first, on the Job in Abomey, Portraits of Working People in Benin. So please give a warm welcome to Darcy and Jim Green.
Thank you very much. In 1969 to 1971, we were Peace Corps volunteers in Benin, in West Africa. Jim's from Boston, and I'm from Seattle, and we both graduated from university, signed up, and met there. So that was one really good plus out of the Peace Corps experience, among many other things. Well, up in the upper left-hand corner, there's this very small inset of Africa, and you'll see Benin is on the lower west edge of Benin. It's a little red spot there. It's a long, narrow country surrounded by Togo on the left, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, and then the Bight of Benin at the bottom. We were in a town called we were in this district. Jim was actually in Dogbo, and I was in a very small village on the road between Aplawe and Abomey. But my research and interests have been in the Abomey area. So it gives you a little context of where we were. I always had a strong interest in returning and going back to Benin. And we had our first opportunity in 2012 when we went back to do a research project on the photographs of a French photographer named Pierre Verger, who photographed in the Abomey Benin area. And while we were there, we had a keen sense of how hard people worked. And while we were doing that project, we frequently asked people, well, what do you do? How did you get into that line of work? How do you feel about it? And based on their answers and responses and our experience, I knew I wanted to do a project on the workers. In 2016, I had a sabbatical from the School of Journalism and we were able to return again. And this time we concentrated specifically on the work. Jim is an integral part. I'm the photographer, and Jim is I did all the writing in the catalog. We interviewed people together and wrote their stories. So we're going to give a little joint presentation, although we haven't practiced it. So that sort of lays the foundation of our interest and while we went there. But Jim will talk a little bit about our procedure.
Yeah, you can see a picture here of the Leganou family. And Constant Leganou, the gentleman seated with that little boy in his lap, he was our research assistant and translator. Now, before we went in 2012, we had heard from a former volunteer that was a good friend of ours that another former volunteer of ours who had been in country in 1969 with us had become a recognized expert on African art and Vodun, voodoo. And so we reached out to Suzanne Blier and we asked her, when she was in Abomey, how did she find a place to stay? Where did she stay? How did she stay there and conduct her research? And she gave us the name of the Leganou family. And this is a family who, for years, had entertained researchers from Europe and from North and South America. And the people who came to spend time with them were interested in exploring the culture, the history, and the religious traditions of the people of Benin, but more specifically in Abomey. So we reached out to the Leganou family. We told them of our interest in coming to take photographs and to learn more about the culture, history, and religions of Abomey. And we made arrangements to stay in their compound for a month. We did so. We arrived and we found that Constant was very, very amenable and helped us a great deal. So Darcy completed her Pierre Verger project in 2012. And as she said, we became really, really fascinated with the way in which people worked. And it was just a reminder of what we had seen during our Peace Corps days from 69 to 71. People worked very hard, and it's not uncommon to find people working two or more jobs to make ends meet. We went back in 2016. Before we went, we emailed Constant pretty regularly, told them about our goals, told them about the types of workers we'd like to meet, and tried to prep him for what it is we wanted to do. We sent him a list of about 55 different jobs that we thought we might be interested in finding more about, interviewing people, taking photographs of people. So we spent another month in 2016 with the Legonou family in their compound in Abomey.
We, when we photographed people, we found that their jobs fit into six different categories. So we wanted to talk about the categories and introduce two of the people. Again, Jim said we photographed over 45 people. We included 40 in the show, and we'll include two from each category in this small series. Again, we'll just want to introduce the project and take you downstairs to actually see the photographs in the gallery. One thing a little bit about the procedure of making the photographs, I used an Olympus camera, a professional Olympus camera, but one of the small versions, and I meant to bring it, but I forgot halfway here, and then I got nervous. I can't run home and come back. But it was a small camera that allowed me not only to shoot conventionally through a viewfinder, but also have a professional waist level finder. So I could communicate with the people while I was setting up photographs, never had a large camera in front of my eyes. So I'm sorry if I'm shouting. We would come and do our interviews first, followed by the photo session. So during the interviews, not only was I learning about the person, they were learning about us, I was able to look around the environment. I chose to make all the photographs in, most of them are all horizontals to include part of the environment as well as the person. I was able to bring a laptop computer and just a small 4x6 printer. So each night I would go home and make these prints and go back the next day and give them to the people. Ultimately, they have also received an exhibition print, which you'll see downstairs, that I was able to send to friends in France who are doing a research project in the area, and they hand carried them to Benin and gave them to Constant, who then got on his motorcycle and drove around and hand delivered them to all the people. So as Jim said, we developed a trust with Constant and then developed trust with the people and gave back what we told them we would give them. And so that really helped. So having the ability to work on my computer every night and edit, print, and return the photographs greatly enhanced our project. So the six categories are traditional arts, contemporary artists, Vodang, commerce, trades, and professions. And Jim will introduce the topics.
This gentleman is Jean-Jacques Jemadjé. He's 49 years old, and he is a tapestry or applique maker. He comes from a family that in the late 18th century was designated by the royal families of Abomey to be applique maker for the royalty, for the kings. And one of the benefits his family continues to carry is that in making his tapestries, he and his family members are allowed to sell them in the Museum of Abomey, which is located at the site of the former royal palaces of Dahomey. So it's quite a prestigious recognition that his family continues to have after all these years. And he also, as a member of that family, has the right to use the symbols of the royal family in his tapestry. other people cannot use those symbols in whatever weavings or tapestries they were to make.
You see him here in his workshop. He's busy at work. He agreed to the interview, but he wouldn't cease working, which, you know, time is money, and was getting slightly annoyed at me when I said, "Well, could you just look at me once?" So it's a very intense photograph, but he was a very intense man.
This is Sylvain Ayenvoken. He's 88 years old, and he is a wood sculptor. He lives in a small village, Mugnon, about 5 miles away from Abomey, and he's been doing this kind of work for about 50 years. Now his sons and his nephews have all become wood sculptors as well, and he's able to sell his carvings to middlemen who can then bring them to Cotonou, which is the country's commercial and administrative capital, and sell them there, or he sells them more locally in Abomey as well.
He's the patriarch of this village, and he has sons, nephews, extended family also doing wood carving. It's an important wood carving village. And he they're all in one area, and he sits by himself in this area. He has quite a few wounds on his legs and his feet because he uses his feet to hold the materials. So you, just by talking to him and looking at him, you can see that this is his job. You'll be able to see it more clearly downstairs.
The young man in the middle is Damien Tokudagba, and he is a very accomplished artist in his own right. And he worked with his father, the famous Cyprian Tokudagba, for 16 years. His father, Cyprian, passed away in 2012. Cyprian Tokudagba achieved a lot of fame because he was asked to repair the bas-reliefs on the royal palaces of Abomey back in the 1980s, and he did so. And he was a very accomplished painter as well. His work was presented in France, Germany, Japan, and even in the United States. So Damien worked closely with his father, and as I said, he became a very distinguished artist in his own right. He sculpts, he paints, and he sews. He has produced an artifact for us that we have on display downstairs in the museum as well. Unfortunately, we learned after we came home that Damien passed away in the fall of 2017. And all we were told was that he had been ill while we were there and was not able to recover, and so he passed away.
You see him here and with his half-brother on the left and an assistant, and they are fabricating and painting these bas-reliefs on the side of an ancestral temple.
If you can see the word at the top there, Sunutan, that's a Fong word, and it means the place where one drinks water. And the family that would own that building, that's where they would conduct ceremonies to their deceased ancestors and use libations. They would spread whatever they needed to spread to honor their ancestors. This young man is named Arlando, and he is a sculptor and a painter and a rather unique individual. His father was a very accomplished civil servant, and he had aspirations for his son going off to university and making a great life for himself. And Arlando had no such intentions of doing so, so his father put him out of the house. So he traveled for about 5 years throughout West Africa, met other artists. He developed a very, very, very keen sense for the environment and in protecting the environment. So over the years, he's used his art to bring attention to the challenges of the environment. All of the masks that you see displayed on the wall behind him are based on his having found objects and turned them into sculptures.
So went back numerous times to Arlando. I'm a wonderful young man. He's really tall and thin. And when we were walking around all his art to find a good place to photograph, I wanted him in front of the masks, But I asked him, but him being tall and thin and the mass being horizontal on the wall, I said, would you mind getting lower, you know, squatting or something? And he just dropped into this very natural, comfortable position. Unless you're in yoga, you know, Americans aren't going to be in that position. But you can see just how comfortable he is. And it just made the photograph to have him be within the masks, not just being a long. And you'll see this little mask in the show downstairs.
This is Wei Denu Nagbo. She's 50 years old, and she's a priestess. And she's a priestess who pays homage to the god Hevioso, which is in Yoruba people, the god of justice, and symbolized by thunder and lightning. When we went to visit Ms. Nagbo in her village, it was about 8 miles away from Abomey, she invited us to come out and she would conduct a little spiritual ceremony for us. So when we entered the area in front of her, we had to remove our shoes and walk to this very small area where she conducted a ceremony for us. And as Darcy and I looked around, we couldn't help but see this incredible kapok tree. And Ms. Nagbo told us that Hevioso resides in the kapok tree. So that's why it is sacred land, and that's why you cannot enter it without being shoeless. She prayed for us, she prayed for our children and grandchildren that they would have good health and success. And Darcy asked her if she would pose in front of the kapok tree, and she said, of course. This is Emmeline Sananmi. She sells herbs in the Abomey market, and she also sells materials that are used in Vodun ceremonies. She's been doing this for well over 30 years. She sells her herbs to traditional healers. She sells them to people who come to her knowing what ails them and wanting certain herbs. And she gives advice to people who are troubled and not really sure what they need to feel better. She is not completely content with her circumstances. She doesn't make enough money. She would love to expand her market stall, sell more things, but she doesn't see any way for her to do such an expansion.
In the show downstairs is not only this photograph, but also a 360 video where you can see a woman who is a herb grower coming to sell her herbs to this woman who will then retail them to other people.
This is Didier Ahuwenje. And this man has quite a story. You can see he's wearing an orange top, orange shirt. In Benin, in most cities, taxis are gotten in the form of motorcycles. So this young man is a motorcycle taxi driver. And in Fon, the predominant local language, the taxi is called the Zemijong, which in Fon means, get me there quick. Now, the orange shirt represents the fact that he's registered to drive in Abomey. He's paid for his license and for the right to drive. His story is a bit sad, however. He, as a young man, went through a 5-year apprenticeship to become a motorcycle mechanic. And when he completed the apprenticeship, he moved about 175 miles north of Abomey to the town of Jugu, which is 2.5 times the size of Abomey. And he established a very successful mechanics practice there. He was there for a number of years, and then he got word that his father had died in Abomey. He was the oldest child in the family, the oldest son, came home immediately to take care of his mother and his siblings. He tried to reestablish his mechanics business in Abomey, but he couldn't. It just wouldn't take, and there was too much competition, and the town's too small to support multiple mechanics. So he took to driving the Zemijon, the motorcycle taxi. When you drive a motorcycle taxi, you drive around town and you wait for potential customers to flag you down, then negotiate a price. Then you take them where they want to go, and then you hope you can find another fare with whom you'll negotiate, and then you'll take them someplace else. He makes considerably less than he made as a motorcycle mechanic. He was very successful in his mechanic business. When I asked him how he felt about what he was doing right now, he looked at us and he said, "In life, one does what one must." So I thought that was a pretty good summation of the world of work, no matter where you find it, huh?
Photographs are amazing media. You can look closely and you can see stories that are not part of the narrative. If you look at this one and you look at him, you see orange shirt, number, taxi driver, taxi. But if you look closer, you'll say, looks like he's wearing a suit. He has matching slacks. He's not wearing torn jeans or African pants, and he's wearing a matching shirt. Which means, as soon as he takes off that motorcycle shirt, he'll walk away as a professional or as a functionary. You know, somebody who is not necessarily working with their hands. And so this talks about the proudness of him and his desire to have a different job. What Jim didn't mention is one of his, or I didn't hear, he'd like to be a trade school teacher, teaching mechanics in a trade school. So he carries himself and he dresses the part where he'd like to be, as opposed to the majority of the taxi drivers that are just hanging out.
This is a married couple. On the right is Theodore Ayomo and his wife Jeanette Zenhumbo. They own and operate a computer business in Abomey. The gentleman had 3 years of technical training at a tech school in Cotonou, the country's commercial capital. His wife completed a community college, junior college degree in general studies. She's 29. They married, and he has trained her, and now she runs the CBER, the little internet facility that they have. He's installed the computers there. She manages it. He does some network system maintenance for some governmental offices around town and some other private computer owners. They were very clear about telling us that they were very successful. They were proud of it, and they thought this was the future. And they had a late model car, healthy children, and a house. This is Bernardin Ahuatu, and he's a Finnish carpenter, and he's a very, very skilled young man. He builds tables, chairs, plaques, wonderful pieces, and he builds coffins as well. But when we met with him, he told us he was thinking about getting out of the business, because when he builds a coffin like the ones you see here, he expends about $40 worth for materials, then he has all of his labor to go into that, and he charges clients about $60. So he makes a $20 profit every time he sells a coffin like that, and he can't make ends meet anymore. Can't afford a belt sander, and he can't afford any other tools that you would think would be the normal tools that a carpenter would use.
So everything is by hand. Yeah. Everything is by hand.
This is Basil Guinemezun, and he's 42 years old. He's a Mason, and just right from the get-go, I'll tell you that young man owns all the property that you see in the photo, and he owns all the structures that are being put up there. He is very successful. He has two work crews. He's got apprentices. He himself did a 5-year apprenticeship, and he went out on his own when he was 21 years old. This compound that he's building here. Oh, it's just a few miles from where he lives, and he lives in a very, very nice brick house. And what did he tell us? He says that he can't find very many apprentices because the work is so demanding that a lot of young men simply don't want to do it. But he says he can find enough young men that he can bring them along.
This photograph is very different from many of my other ones, because you see that he is so small. One reason he's so small is because I really wanted to emphasize the bricks. Where do bricks come from in the U.S.? You call up Lowe's or, you know, somebody, and they bring a big truckload of them. He has to make his own bricks. So these young men that don't necessarily want to work too hard have to dig up the ground, mix the dirt with water and cement, form them, lay them out to dry. The reason there's no work going on here is because the bricks are drying. They had to go in stages. They make the bricks, they dry the bricks, then they build the structures. And so I just felt I just needed to show, you know, how much work was involved in building a wall. It's not as simple as ordering the bricks from the supply house. And again, as successful as he is, motorcycles are the main transportation. He has access, or we didn't really talk about if he owned a truck, but his main transportation is motorcycles.
This is Leopold Sacchetti. He's 67 years old, and he's a veterinarian. He spent 7 years at university training, worked for the government of Benin for 25 years, retired, and he's been in private practice in Abomey, I think for like the last 10 years. Very interesting guy. He's outside of his clinic there, and inside he's got feed and medications, and he can see smaller animals that people bring to him, but if he has to go out into the countryside to take care of larger animals, he does have an automobile, which is highly unusual, and he charges extra for house calls.
Again, with photography, it's all a photographer has is what's available. Now, some photographers are conceptual photographers, and they bring props and they create images. But I'm more of a documentary photographer, a photojournalist, and so I rely on what's there, and I don't remove things. But that cat removed herself. And I couldn't believe it. I sat through with a whole interview with watching this cat thinking, okay, as soon as we're done, I'm going to get that cat. And so I was kind of rude. I pushed Jim out of the way and I'm setting up, and the cat left. I said, oh no, I was so disappointed.
The cat left because you pushed me out of the way. But, he was as insulted as I was.
But by the time I was truly ready, the cat came back. So this photograph, I did not grab the cat, force the cat, kill the cat, glue the cat. You know, the cat came back and I was able to get the photograph.
This is Michel Leganou. He's 46 years old and he's an assistant in the mayor's office, assistant to the administrative services branch of the mayor's office in Abomey. But in addition to that, he's the secretary general of one of the local unions that exists within the mayor's office. And as a union rep, he finds that things do not go well for him or other members of the union. The mayor's office and the administrative group, they spend considerable time talking about contract language, signing off on contract language, and then completely ignoring contract language. So he goes to workshops, bargaining workshops, negotiation workshops, and informational workshops on the weekend at his own expense. And he's not reimbursed for doing this. I think they pay him for his meals while he's at these workshops. But we spoke with him for well over an hour, and he had lots and lots of stories about how colleagues of his had been promoted, how colleagues of his had gotten raises, how other colleagues of his had been reassigned to very far distant locations in the middle of nowhere, depending upon the level of union activity that one pursued. So he didn't have a real positive story to tell, but nevertheless, he was sticking with it and was going to remain a union rep.
And the only way to photograph him is he came to us on a Sunday because we would not be have access to go in and talk to him in the mayor's office.
When we go through these photos, these three pairs, we'd like you to consider the age, the gender, family heritage, the kind of job training, and then the work itself as you look at each of these photos. This is Leon Hosenugan, and he's a blacksmith. He's 74 years old. He's done the work for many, many years, and in fact, he's become renowned for the work he does with that item he's holding, which is called an asan, which is a ceremonial altar. And it's used, it was used historically by the kings of Abomey in their courts, and they would be designed to depict various heroic scenes that the royal families would engage in. But over time, ordinary people began to ask to have asan fabricated for them, sometimes just for family remembrances, other times to have to use in Vodun ceremonies. Well, what's happened over the years is with the emergence of evangelical churches in Benin, in Abomey for sure, a lot of the congregations have been discouraged from purchasing any items that would be considered useful in Vodun ceremonies. So this used to be the blacksmith's bread and butter because he was so good at designing these things. And now his sales are dwindling of these kinds of items. This is a young man who is a photo technician, Tunde Ayane. He's 20 years old. His father was a photographer, trained him to be a photographer. Then he went to work in Ketu, the town where he's from, with some people who were involved in digital image processing. He spent about 6 years with them, learned that, came back to Abomey, and now he works as a digital processor in the building in back of him. And he basically told Darcy that he could spare her 5 minutes because he was busy. And was he ever. This guy is up and coming. He is the only person that does this skill in all of Abomey, so he's in demand. And when you think about the blacksmith and you think about the photo technician, think about the age, the jobs that they have, where they're going in the future, it's interesting. This woman is a potter, and she's 69 years old. Her name is Elizabeth Abahunje, and she's been doing this for many, many years. Her mother and grandfather, mother and grandmother before her were potters. So this is a family heritage that she's taken on. She's very successful. She has a big roadside spot where she shows her pots. And in the background, you can't see it very well, but she has her oven and where she cooks her pots and cures them. She says that no matter how old she becomes, she'll continue to do this work because she says she's compelled to do it.
So very successful.
Very successful. This young woman is Elizabeth Adigbli. She's 25 years old. She's completed her university studies and she's completed her training to be qualified to be a primary school teacher. This is a picture of her in her primary school. She's considered a volunteer because there are far more teachers, qualified teachers available in Benin than there are positions to fill within the teaching ranks. So she volunteers and receives 1/3 the salary that her colleagues receive at the same school. At the end of the school year, because she's a volunteer, she'll have to retake the national qualifying exam, and she'll have to hope that she'll get a placement somewhere. She was very discouraged when we spoke with her. What we found out was later, the day that this photo was taken, the outgoing president of Benin published a list of teachers that were going to be granted full-time status in the next school year. And her name was on that list. The day, 5 days after the new president came into office, he made a proclamation that that list had been nullified. So one day, she thinks, I'm on easy street, I'll have my career. 5 days later, with a change, a political change in presidential regimes, she's back out on the street. The last we heard, she had just washed her hands of teaching. She just thought she'll never have an opportunity to do this.
An old potter, successful young teacher, very disappointed.
This gentleman is a traditional weaver, and like the applique maker we showed you, he is descendant of a family that was given a royal designation many, many years ago, hundreds of years ago, and his family continues to weave. He also is able, because of his family's lineage, to weave royal family symbols and figures into his weavings. Very successful. He sells his products at the royal palaces of Abomey, at the museum there. This young woman is also a weaver. You can see she's using an upright loom. Her parents were both weavers, but had no such designation from the royal families historically. So she works as a patroness to two young apprentices. She's teaching weaving, but she also is able to sell her weavings in the location of her workshop. It's a workshop that's operated by the Catholic Church, and the looms have been provided by the Catholic Church as well. She's free to sell her weavings there, but she will never be allowed to sell her weavings at the royal palaces of Abomey because she is not a descendant of the families that were given that designation. She also cannot sell her weavings at the workshops of the more established weavers. So in the picture you saw earlier of that gentleman, he has his own workshop. She could never approach him and say, could I sell my weavings here as well? Just couldn't happen.
So her future is limited, whereas he will continue weaving and selling it where the tourists come. The tourists can't find her necessarily. You know, she doesn't have a way of advertising or bringing them into this little workshop.
But you'll see her work downstairs.
Beautiful. Okay, John, we're ready for questions.
Okay. Well, first of all, before we go any further, please give Jim and Darcy a round of applause. And maybe just one question for starters, and then I'd love to open it up. Could you tell us a little bit about levels of employment and unemployment in Benin generally? That is there are jobs hard to come by, and therefore your story about the person who says it's hard to find apprentices that are willing to work? Could you tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Good question. Okay. And why don't you add the percents?
Yeah, I've got a little... Not a chart, but a little, here it is. Yeah, just, I can throw this out. 37% of the people you'll see in the exhibit, they're following in the footsteps of a family member. They got guidance at home. They got training at home. Another 35% of the people you'll see in the exhibit, they either had apprenticeships or went to a technical school for training. 25% of the workers you'll see in the exhibit have at least two jobs, sometimes more. And 25% of the people we interviewed expressed some degree, a little or a lot, of frustration with their workplace circumstances. Many of the people that we met participate in the informal economy in Benin. And other people call the informal economy the off-the-books economy, and by that is meant that people who participate in the informal economy pay no taxes. But in addition, people who participate in the informal economy have no recourse to government protection of any kind. So a lot of the jobs, long hours, low pay, discrimination, bullying, it's not easy to have a job or to have two jobs in Benin. I think the World Bank estimates that 65% of the economy in Benin is informal, and 90% of the population work in the informal economy.
Okay, so let's open it up for questions. Questions?
Yes.
Bill? How is it that you picked this particular location? Was it your familiarity with it, or were there other reasons?
It was our familiarity with it. It's very difficult to show up and make a cold call someplace. And we had established previous work there, and we had a research assistant, and we felt comfortable there. We knew, we spoke French, we could interact with in the national language as well as We had Constant and some phone to help us with. So we weren't really learning a whole new culture to explore the work. So yes, it was a familiar.
And it was the area where we had both served as Peace Corps volunteers, very, very close to Abomey. So we kind of knew the territory.
Had it changed much?
Not as much as we had hoped.
What's everywhere now are cell phones and cell towers. And in 1969 to 1971, non-existent cell phones everywhere. But still very, very bad roads, no mechanized farming, you know, a lot of things that were disappointing in a way, but still very real circumstances.
Other questions? Yes.
A couple of quick questions. Benin or Benin?
Benin. Benin or Benin than I do.
Benin. In French, it's Benin.
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 Benin. Benin. Yeah.
But she says it Benin and you said it Benin. I thought.
Right.
I think I was using maybe the more English and she was, okay. I don't know, but it's the Republic of Benin.
Benin.
The French. Yeah. If you're speaking with a French speaking person, they'll tell you it's Benin.
Also,
is that accurate?
They don't pronounce the last name.
Yeah.
It's not Benin.
Benin.
Benin. It's a nasal.
Benin.
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 I
am.
No N. I mean, okay. No, Benin.
It's there, but yeah, you don't pronounce. You kind of.
Also, you mentioned Bodun. Am I in error? Is that voodoo?
It is.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, that's important to bring up that people in the United States get their voodoo experience from Hollywood. And they think we're going to stick pins in dolls and do bad things. I like to think of it more like, what do you do when you lose something? Well, if you're Catholic, you're going to ask St. Anthony to find it. Okay, and the gods of Africa, of our experience, now Africa is a huge continent, so we can only speak to Benin. The different gods have different interests, different powers, and one goes to the god that can help them. We talked about Hevioso, there's the god of iron, Ogun, there's Mamiwata, there's lots of different gods, just like there's lots of different saints that have specialties. And most people, well, people go for them for good. I do know that people go to get ahead of business and get my brother out of my way type of thing, but it's not the voodoo concept that we have. It was really quite comfortable. I know you've had experience with it. Other people may have had experience with it. It's not an evil thing when you're there.
Other questions? Back to Dorothy.
You mentioned that somebody is making bricks, and my question is, how do they get the bricks to the construction site? I assume it's a cart.
No.
Is it pulled by horses? Is it pulled by people? Is it pulled by automobiles?
The bricks are made on the construction site. So when they dig out any kind of, they might be built, digging out a hole for a cistern or a latrine, then they use that. Or they just make a hole someplace. So it's right on site.
So there aren't any large buildings that require bringing in stuff?
There are a few. There were some multi-story buildings, yeah. And I wondered how that happened. They would be, but even Fabienne had a two-story building in the village. So. But I did not see any, they do have lorries, but that would be a huge expense to hire a lorry, get it packed up and brought out. So.
Let me ask a quick aside, because of the photos, and by the way, first of all, the photos are magnificent, both in the
please
exhibit.
Don't assume this is a photo, this is a projected slide.
So help us understand the importance of traditional dress in your experience both in Benin.
Benin.
I'll get it. It could be a long time, but I'll get it. Because of the fact that many people were in traditional dress, Was that because they knew they were going to be photographed that day, or is it very strong in terms of traditional dress? And naturally, many of the people in traditional dress seem to be older rather than younger. So could you help us understand a little bit about that?
It's a good question. Now, the traditional dress is an everyday affair. Now, she's in a traditional dress in that it's a top and a panya, just a wrap around cloth. She's wearing kind of a Western t-shirt, but most of them prefer to have a matching cloth top and this wraparound skirt. It's called a panya. Okay, this is a very formal one. When we interviewed him, he was wearing very casual clothes, and I said, would you mind to be photographed now? And we actually know this man because we met him in 2012, so we've had a history with him. And I said, he was ready. And I said, oh, wouldn't you like to wear something else? Because it was kind of a cutaway t-shirt, you know, he'd been working. And he said, oh. Then we waited for a half hour. You know, went, took a shower and got dressed and brought in two hats. Couldn't decide which one he wanted to wear. So that was fine. So this is for the photograph.
Right.
For the photograph. This one is a very fancy shirt with the embroidery on it. And it's a Sunday. He knew he was being photographed. But he's just at his job.
Right.
And choosing very Western. It was a non-work day, but he didn't know he was going to be photographed. We asked him if he would give us an interview, and so we all went out to the work site. So the traditional dress is very comfortable there every day. And you're right, the young people and some people choose to wear Western clothes.
Western,
yeah.
Okay. Susan?
I'm wondering how he got around. Was it on a motorcycle, taxi?
Yes. Because Constant had a motorcycle, usually rode with Constant, and we flagged down a taxi for Jim. Yes.
I wondered about the photo technician. What was his product? You said he was so busy, but what was his product?
He was the only concession in town that had a Macintosh computer, a Photoshop software, and a digital printer. So people could come with their SD cards from their phones and or cameras, and he would make enlargements. And no competition.
What's the, like you said something about the roads, and I would expect that, but I mean, is there solar power? What's the infrastructure like there? Is there electricity? Do they have water versus the water? Do they have to walk? My experience in that part of the country, a lot of people have to walk long distances for water.
Right.
But I didn't, you know.
In the town, they have water sources.
Okay.
And they have solar street lamps.
Okay.
They have electricity. Now, it's not constant. You know, it's intermittent electricity comes into homes of people who have contracted for it. There's some, you'll see, you know, poles and wires and things. And you'll see a cell phone towers and dishes. People with televisions have a dish. In the villages, they don't have necessarily any of those.
Yeah, no running water, no plumbing, or no electricity.
Even our water, we had a bathroom in our little space, but we had a big bucket. Mm-hmm. And when the water ran, you filled the bucket up. And so when the water wasn't there, you could still, you know, flush the toilet and have water.
Bill? You mentioned tourists. What's the attraction for tourists?
This, Albemay is the kingdom of Dahomey.
The seat
of the kingdom of Dahomey. All the kings have been there. The palaces are still there. It's a UNESCO site.
World Heritage Site. Yeah.
So people come. Not droves, not New York City, you know, just, but it is a draw.
Yeah, it is a draw.
And researchers come.
Yeah. Yeah, the Fole people, the predominant local tribe, it said that in like the early 1600s, they began building palaces for the kings. And there's kind of a sad story associated with the rise of the kingdom of Dahomey. There were many, many wars and battles and so forth. And unfortunately, a number of the people that would be captured in battle in the 1700s, the kings that were victorious realized that they could be sold to the Europeans. So they would march them down to the coast to the town of Ouidah, and they would sell them to the Portuguese, French, the English. And that went on for quite some time, and it's a very sad chapter in the history of the Kingdom of Dahomey. It wasn't the only place where that happened, but the kings were thought to be very wily, but also very ruthless, and they intimidated their enemies terribly. And a lot of the people that arrived in the Caribbean, in North and South America, Brazil, were brought there against their will from Benin.
And it's also the birthplace of Vaudan. So anybody studying Vaudan will go there as well.
So there are jobs in tourism?
There are hotels. Two of the people you'll meet downstairs, one is a tour guide and his wife is a hotel operator. There are some restaurants. Because we stayed in a compound, we didn't frequent the hotels and restaurants, but there are some there.
Other questions? Yes.
Could you mention something about the government and the education system?
Okay. The government, it's considered to be a democratic republic, has three branches of government, multiple political parties that are all free to campaign and do what they'd like. The economy is not strong. There was hope a number of years ago that an oil deposit that had been discovered in the ocean close to Nigerian territorial waters, but maybe in Beninese territorial waters, but then it played out that that really wasn't the deposit that they thought it was going to be. So it's still largely driven by agriculture, exporting cotton primarily, palm oil. The infrastructure is still not good. The road system is not good. There's only two or three paved roads throughout the country. There's one train line, and it only goes from the coast to Parakou, which is about halfway up the country going north. Free elections are held. There's complaining about elections. Go figure. I have no idea. And there's reports of corruption in the elections. But the National Assembly sits in a beautiful building in Cotonou. It's a parliamentary form of government. And the president has a lot of power. There's a judicial with a Supreme Court. Does that help answer a little bit?
Very good.
No. Thank God their government is so different than ours, right, from what we've heard. Yes.
France still has a great deal of influence in Francophone.
It's the France educational system.
That's the French educational system.
When we were there, and it wasn't mandatory. Now everyone's supposed to go to school.
Girls and boys.
Back in the 70s, it was only the rich farmers might send their daughters and sons. Moderate farmers would send their sons. Poor farmers wouldn't send anybody. So the girls were always shortchanged. So the kids all get, there's private schools, church schools, state schools. So you see lots of children running around in different uniforms, identifiable by what school they go to. But during harvest, they wouldn't necessarily be in school.
So I had two questions. The first, you didn't mention Christian churches very much. So I'm imagining there actually were a lot. But were they, am I wrong? And were they Catholic and evangelical? And then the second question is, since your projects all work, we're seeing people with work. So I'm curious about your noticing people who didn't work. Was there much noticeable, young people not finding jobs, or what was your experience there?
Well, first off, lots of Catholic churches, growing number of evangelical churches. growing number of mosques in the south of Benin. When Darcy and I lived and worked there in 69, 71, the Muslim population was to the far north, up by Niger and Upper Volta, at the time Upper Volta, but Burkina Faso. But now, because the economy has been so poor in the north, a lot of Muslim families are moving to the south, and so more and more mosques are being constructed in the south. And Ken, what was the
unemployment?
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of young people that have university degrees that have no prospects, especially in education. If you were to hope to become a teacher, there's just an incredible surplus of credentialed people, and there aren't enough positions to find work for them. And a lot of other young people who get maybe two-year degrees or technical school training, not enough jobs for those people either.
Were they trying to make their way to Europe? Did you get any?
I didn't get the sense in Benin that that was happening. No, no.
Okay, and back.
Given your background in journalism, what can you say about the press?
We interviewed a radio journalist. I said, oh, great, you know, he was a journalist. Turns out he covers a few local stories. He mostly reads stories from the capital newspapers on the air, and has and part of his job is to sell items off over the air. So I did not have the opportunity to truly discover what is journalism there, because I was it was not happening as I would have hoped in Abomey, and there was no newspaper. Although I went to the radio station, I wasn't able to talk to editors. It's interesting, the bureaucracy is so strong. You need permissions and stamps to do things. I went as a journalist. I didn't go as a researcher, so I did not go through the red tape of getting into the country with all these permissions. But because I didn't have permissions, there's some places I couldn't get into either. But it's the bureaucracy is just really difficult. The pictures you don't see. You don't see a soldier. You don't see a policeman. You don't hear or in an exhibit. People would, although we talked to a medical doctor at a hospital, just had a discussion with him. He said he would make inquiries and get back to us. All the few times we kept re-inquiring, they were maybe, it never happened. So the people that have more to lose or less confidence, more people to answer to, we didn't get access to.
And if I could add something else, when that began to surface and we understood that there were some professions we were not going to be able to photograph, we interviewed the postmaster in Abomey, and at the end of the interview, he refused to have his picture taken. And rather than, and he was a very unpleasant person to begin with, but we don't even know why he agreed to sit for the interview, but he did. Rather than push it a little bit further, what we realized was the old adage, we're going home, Constant still lives here. Do you want to have his mail delivery, or however that all works, get compromised? And then, there's a military encampment in Abomey, and we saw soldiers in full dress, armed, walking around town. And we decided, we're not gonna approach the commander of the garrison. Two old white European people, what the hell are you doing? Why do you want to take a picture of me or my troops? Same thing with the police department. And with the police department, we kept thinking, if they know we're with the Leganu family and they think that maybe we're trying to push them into doing something they don't want to do, we just said, we're not doing it. Same with the doctor. The doctor had access to nurses, ambulance drivers, other professions that could have been of interest. When the doctor just politely said, I don't think this is going to happen, we just dropped it.
Well,
in the interest of getting everyone downstairs, let us give them another round of applause.